time for what it says in the papers with Valerie Cox.
46, the number of days since the trial against the three former directors of Anglo Irish Bank began. 16, the number of charges originally brought against Sean Fitzpatrick. 10, the number of businessmen given loans by Anglo to buy shares in Anglo in July 2008. 13 hours, 29 minutes, the time the jury spent deliberating before acquitting Mr. Fitzpatrick. That timeline comes from the Irish Times, but all the papers and all the front pages carry photographs of the former chairman of Anglo-Irish Bank outside the Dublin Circuit Criminal Court following his acquittal yesterday on all counts of providing unlawful financial assistance to the so-called Maple 10 businessmen to buy Anglo shares. Miriam Lord in the Times describes the scene in the corridor outside court number 19 when Sean Fitzpatrick asked journalists how they thought the case would go. And Sarah Stack in the Irish Independent says over the weeks of the trial, he visibly relaxed into his surroundings in the biggest criminal courts complex in the country, and his happy-go-lucky persona gradually re-emerged. Fitzpatrick case hung on single phone call with ex-Anglo chief Drum, says the paper's headline. A handshake, a wink, now leave me alone, is the Irish Daily Mail's headline. Smiling Shawnee walks free, is how the Irish Daily Mirror puts it. Grinning Shawnee in the clear, is the Irish Daily Star's angle. Shawnee walks, says the Herald. Anglo's Shawnee walks, says the Irish Sun. And Fitzpatrick pleads for privacy after acquittal, is how the Irish Examiner heads its story. Although it doesn't make the lead for the Examiner. That's reserved for a report from Owen English that there are signs of a gradual recovery in family finances, with a slight increase in the number of people who have more than €100 left at the end of the month once all their bills are paid. The green shoots of recovery are starting to be seen around the country, says the editorial in the Mirror. But the Mail sees the result of the survey conducted by the Irish League of Credit Unions as quite negative. €25, that's all we're left with each week, it says. And one of those bills will be water. John Downing in The Independent says Labour's behaviour in the debate yesterday has left them looking weak and toothless, where they set out to try to look assertive. We've known since autumn 2009 that water charges were likely at some stage, he says. It was just a case of when and how much. And Senan Maloney in the Mail says the free water allowance won't even cover the barest essentials. To avoid charges, people would have to limit themselves to two showers a week, use the dishwasher and washing machine once a week, and flush the toilet just twice a day. Coverage of the final day of the Association of Garda Sergeants and Inspectors Conference continues. And Cormac O'Keefe in The Examiner reports that Gardaí face the risk of a raft of civil actions as members are not properly trained to use batons and pepper sprays. President Tim Galvin told the conference that members have to be recertified every 3 years to use the weapons, and the last time he was certified was in 2010. Finally, Dan Buckley in The Examiner reports on a novel approach to writing a CV. Brian O'Sullivan applied for a marketing position with the Heineken Brewery, and he displayed his CV on the labels of a six-pack of Heineken bottles. It was my creative way of trying to stand out from the crowd, he said. The bad news is he didn't get the job. It was too senior a position, but they liked his CV.
Thank you very much, Valerie. It's always interesting to see how a major news story here, like, for example, the verdict at the Central Criminal Court that cleared Sean Fitzpatrick of all charges yesterday, is being reported elsewhere. And the strength of the British newspapers to hand this morning, it is covered in all of those papers, but well inside on the business pages. But one exception, and you can imagine why, is the Financial Times, which has a particular interest, obviously, in Irish business and banking. And they have a page one headline on the verdict of the jury of the Central Criminal Court. Face of Irish crisis cleared of loan fraud, says the headline on a report by Vincent Boland, to whom we've spoken many times on the programme, which starts, just to give you the flavour of it, Sean Fitzpatrick, the banker who became synonymous with the collapse of Ireland's financial system, has been cleared of making fraudulent loans after one of the longest and most complex corporate trials in the country's history. Now, that trial, as I was saying, is of course by no means over. Two men still before the court and the jury to continue its deliberations today. today, but we're joined by RTE's legal affairs correspondent Orla O'Donnell, who was in court yesterday afternoon at the moment when the jury came back and Sean Fitzpatrick was cleared, as I said, of all charges. How exactly did that happen and what was the scene, Orla?
Yes, it was 5 o'clock, Cathal, and we were expecting the jury to come back in at that stage and be sent home for another night. But when they came out of their room, we noticed that the forewoman was carrying an issue paper. This is the paper on which they write their decisions. So at that stage, of course, the atmosphere in the courtroom, the Dublin Circuit Criminal Court, changed and people realised that a verdict, some kind of verdict, was imminent. The registrar asked the forewoman had they reached verdicts. She said yes, and then the verdicts were read in court, and quickly it became clear that Sean Fitzpatrick was to be cleared of the 10 counts remaining against him, that of giving illegal loans to the Maple 10 to buy shares in Anglo-Irish Bank in July 2008. Now, he was remarkably composed after the verdicts were announced. All the more so, his composure was all the more remarkable because earlier on in the day, he'd come up to some of us and seemed quite anxious and told us that he believed in no uncertain terms that he was going to be convicted that day. And so he must have been particularly surprised to hear his acquittal. But he retained his composure. He winked at his legal team, at his family. His sister and his daughter have been in court most days. And afterwards, he shook hands with his co-accused. He was told by Judge Martin Nolan that he was free to go, and he went to consult with his family and his legal team before emerging outside the court sometime later.
Well, by the way, I should mention, and thank you for reminding me, it is the Circuit Criminal Court, not the Central Criminal Court. I should mention, some of you probably realise this, but we are very much in the middle of a trial which is not yet over, and therefore people have all kinds of opinions and all kinds of conversations, mm-hmm. and some of it online, but we've got to be restricted for obvious and sensible reasons, because this case is still before a jury in relation to two men, and we'll come to that in a moment. Can you just remind us of what charges Sean Fitzpatrick face and which he's been cleared of in relation to all of them?
Well, he was charged under Section 60 of the 1963 Companies Act, and this was the first criminal prosecution under that section of the Companies Act, the first criminal prosecution in 50 years. This section prohibits a company from lending money to buy its own shares. There's an exception if lending is the ordinary business of the company and if the lending is in the ordinary course of the bank's business. Sean Fitzpatrick had originally been charged with 16 counts under this section. He was accused of giving unlawful financial assistance to Patricia Quinn, that's Sean Quinn, wife, and their 5 children. But the judge had ruled earlier that he should be acquitted of those charges because there was no evidence that he knew about the lending to the Quinns. And it's notable that in the 5 Garda interviews with Sean Fitzpatrick that were read to the jury during this trial, there was actually no mention. He wasn't asked about any lending to the Quinns in relation to this transaction. And so there was no evidence about this, and the judge directed an acquittal. He was then also charged with 10 charges of giving illegal loans to the Maple 10. And these were 10 businessmen, 10 developers who were asked by Anglo-Irish Bank to buy some of the shares that were behind Sean Quinn's 29% interest in Anglo-Irish Bank, and the bank lent money to these people, the court heard, and that's what he was charged with.
Now, there are 2 men still before the court. Tell us just what charges they face and on which the jury will begin deliberations in a couple of hours.
Yes, Patrick Whelan, who's Anglo's former head of lending in Ireland, and William McAteer, who was Anglo's former finance director. They were executives at Anglo at the time. They are charged with 16 counts of giving unlawful financial assistance to the Quinns and to the Maple 10. And as you say, the jury are still deliberating on those charges, and they will start again. We don't know how far they've got, obviously. They'll start again at 10:30 this morning.
Orla, thank you. It's time for the early business news from Emma McNamara.
Thanks, Cathal. And more on that story Valerie mentioned from the papers and the Credit Union Tracker. The head of the Irish League of Credit Unions, Kieran Brennan, says that over the past 12 months, the first signs of possible economic recovery are visible. And according to that new tracker by the League, for all adults, monthly disposable income has increased by €13 since April 2013. And for working adults, that disposable income has increased by €20 since April 2013. There's also been a fall in the number of people who Workers say their disposable income has decreased and more people are in a position to save compared to this time last year. And the Credit Union Tracker, which has been published now for 4 years, follows how people around the country have been hit by austerity and recession and records the impact the shift in the economy has had on family finances. And we'll have more on this at 10 to 8. Google shares fell by 3% in after-hours trading after the company posted first quarter earnings and sales that missed expectations. Of most concern was a 9% drop in payments from marketers per ad on Google sites. Analysts say that Google's challenge now is to convince marketers to pay as much for mobile ads as they do for desktop ads as web use shifts to smartphones. Google still reported a $15.4 billion in sales for the first 3 months of the year, and that's up 19% on last year. And the value of the most valuable or expensive, depending on how you look at it, ever golden parachute was revealed yesterday by the US Securities and Exchange Commission. It was paid to the former Yahoo chief operating officer Enrique de Castro, and he left Yahoo with a severance package worth $58 million. Mr. de Castro worked at Yahoo for 15 months. And new public procurement guidelines aimed at making it easier for small businesses to bid for work across the public sector will be announced later today by Minister Brian Hayes. The new guidelines should make public procurement more accessible by SMEs and groups of small companies. And on the currency markets this morning, the euro is trading at $1.384 and at 82.2 pence sterling.
Thank you very much, Emma.
Talks get underway in Geneva today between Russia, Ukraine, the United States and the EU in an effort to resolve the escalating tensions over eastern Ukraine. As those talks begin, Ukrainian attempts to stop pro-Russian groups from taking over key buildings in towns and cities in the east have hit stumbling blocks. David Blair is the chief foreign correspondent with the Daily Telegraph, and just before we came on air, he joined us from Donetsk and began by describing what has been happening there.
There were two extraordinary incidents yesterday. In the first, the army lost six of its own armoured personnel carriers when a group of soldiers were surrounded by civilians who simply refused to let them enter the village and eventually persuaded the soldiers to hand over their own armoured cars. And in the second incident, about 150 soldiers were disarmed by a group of civilians who persuaded them to hand over first the magazines from their rifles, then their entire stock of ammunition, and lastly the firing pins from their weapons. So this column of soldiers was rendered entirely helpless. And I think that shows that they simply don't have the will that's needed to carry out this operation successfully.
Why not, do you think? Why do you think the will isn't there?
Well, in many ways, it reflects very well upon the individual soldiers concerned. When they're confronted by crowds of unarmed civilians, who are, of course, fellow Ukrainians, they're not prepared to open fire on them. And so rather than have a terrible incident, they've shown that they are actually prepared to lay down their weapons. Now, that may reflect well on the individuals concerned, but for the military high command to get itself into a position where its planning is so poor, its orders are so confused, and the rules of engagement are so unclear that their soldiers feel that they have to behave in this way is quite extraordinary. And it shows that Kiev's attempt to reimpose its control over this region by force is simply going nowhere.
So you have a weak government in Kiev and you have civilians in the eastern part where pro-Russian groups are trying to push in, just saying, go ahead, do as you will.
There is a strange sense of indifference to whichever armed faction happens to be controlling the government building in whichever town you're talking about here in Donetsk region. When armed men take over, for example, the city hall in Donetsk yesterday, ordinary people in the streets don't really react to this. They're not particularly surprised by it. You and I might be quite alarmed if a group of men with Kalashnikov assault rifles wearing masks took over our local city hall. But people here aren't. And I think that's partly because there's a degree of passive support for the occupations. And it's partly because of a profound sense of disillusionment, which means that people here tend to think that it doesn't really matter who's in charge. Their lives will carry on in much the same way anyway.
So how does all of this then, David, inform the talks that are getting underway in Geneva later today?
Well, it means that Russia most certainly has the upper hand. if Ukraine is unable to reimpose its rule over this region, then it's very clear that Russia's attempt to increase its own influence is working very well indeed. And what I expect is that today Russia will come up with some formula whereby they say the people of Donetsk region should be allowed to choose their own future. And meanwhile, their allies here on the ground will probably demand a referendum on the future status of Donetsk region. And we will eventually have a replay of the Crimea scenario, where there will be a referendum and the people of Donetsk will be given a choice between union with Russia or complete autonomy within Ukraine.
You could take a very simplistic view and say, what's wrong with that?
Well, indeed. I mean, if... So far, no one or very few people have been killed in this part of Ukraine, which is a good thing. So far, very few shots have been fired. There hasn't been much fighting. If the status of this region can be, as it were, settled without further bloodshed, then you could argue that that is a good thing. However, there is an important principle at stake, which is that one country shouldn't be able to effectively annex the territory of another through behind-the-scenes subversion, which is effectively what's happening here. I mean, let's not forget that Russia is the hidden hand behind all the events here. And rather than do something quite so obvious and aggressive as mount an invasion by sending tanks over the border, Vladimir Putin is very cleverly seeking to manipulate the situation behind the scenes instead. Internal subversion is his chosen method for imposing his will on this part of Ukraine.
David Blair there, the chief foreign correspondent with the Daily Telegraph, joining us from Donetsk. And a little later on in the programme, we'll be speaking to our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, as those talks get underway in Geneva aimed at resolving the Ukraine crisis.
Now, this tension between Fine Gael and Labour, which first emerged during yesterday's programme when the Labour side of the government told us not to expect agreement on the new water charges at yesterday's meeting of the Cabinet. Is this a genuine row or a bout of competitive leaking or maybe a bit of both? We'll discuss that in a moment. But first, our reporter Barry Lenehan called backbenchers from both parties last night and here's what they told him. First, Labour's Sean Kenny.
Has to be discussed further by the Labour ministers in Cabinet. It wasn't properly thought and it was rushed, and the issues need to be discussed further. The issues of the metering and people's ability to pay, these issues have to be addressed.
Pat Deering, Fine Gael TD for Carol Kilkenny. I think the big issue at the moment is that people need to know exactly how much they're actually going to have to pay. The figure that has been quoted seems to be fairly accurate in my understanding, €240 per year for water. I would see that as being a realistic figure. Once the final packages is put together, I think the difference will be ironed out.
Michelle Mulhern, TD for County Mayo. I have no idea what discussions go on at the Labour Parliamentary Party meeting. I just think that clarity is needed. You know, I would say on every issue, and even within parties themselves, there can be differences. These things have to be teased out. And why wouldn't there be challenges? You know, I'm not aware of any of those divisions, especially with my own backbench Labour colleagues.
Ciarán Lynch, Labour Party TD for Cork South Central. Labour ministers were very clear at Cabinet today that the current proposals or any proposals at the moment are not going to be actually put out there. The critical issue here is that we get a proper pricing model in place. The timing of this is not the issue. The greater priority is actually ensuring that a fair and equitable and pricing system is put in place.
Catherine Bourne, TD for Fine Gael, Dublin South Central. I listened to the tarnished Eamon Gilmore speak about it as well, and he said, of course there's difference, but there are differences that will be sorted out, and I believe over the next couple of weeks that will happen, and people before the local elections will know exactly where they stand. I don't see any animosity between two parties about this.
Deputy Kevin Humphreys, Labour Party for Dublin Bay South. Well, I think at all stages the electorate realised that there was going to be water charges brought in, and I think Fine Gael has acted in a dishonourable manner in the manner way this has been leaked out. There's a lot of problems are to be resolved between the Labour Party and Fine Gael in relation to this. There's an awful lot more to be agreed and discussed between our coalition partners, and I don't think this has been helped by the manner that this their position has been leaked to the newspapers. I can't speak for my party, but certainly I would not be as trusting towards Fine Gael after this.
And that's the Labour TD, Kevin Humphreys. And we began that ring around, by the way, the voice, first voice you heard was from Labour TD, Sean Kenny. We're joined by Fiach Kelly, a political reporter with the Irish Times. That statement, Fiach, by Catherine Byrne there, she doesn't see any animosity between the parties. Do you?
I think there is animosity between the parties. I think when we look back on the series of government crises that may mark this coalition's term in office, this won't feature up amongst the most difficult or the most crucial. I think it was more about process than substance, and the trust that Labour felt was somewhat betrayed by the fact that Fine Gael tried to, as they see it, bounce them into agreement on the level of water charges and leak the what they believed the average charge would be, 240 or there or thereabouts. There's not much between the two parties in substance when you think about it. There is broad agreement, even on Monday night, there was broad agreement between the assessed charges, whereas Labour says its main problem is that's where, if you don't have a water meter installed, they will give you an estimate of what they think you're using. The way that is being put is that will be based, say, if you live in a semi-detached house in a housing estate with two kids, if there's someone down the road who lives in a semi-detached house, has two kids as well, you'll be hit with their charge. And then when eventually you get your water meter, you will be able to claim a rebate if you're being charged too much. There's also agreement on the level of the standing charge, broadly, €50 or slightly less. There is broadly agreement on the actual estimated charge, 240 or thereabouts. And it's difficult to see where there's differences, apart from the fact that Fine Gael tried to get the jump on Labour on the issue.
Yeah, in terms of leaking all the information about what was going to Cabinet yesterday, in terms of facts and figures and so on. But the Labour line, as coming out from those TDs we heard there, is that they're fighting the fight for people who are the poor people. Hmm. Is that a credible line?
It's the line they're sticking to. The simple fact is Labour are more politically sensitive to this issue than Fine Gael are. Fine Gael are operating on the base that Enda Kenny told the electorate, you will know how much you're paying before Easter. Fine Gael say, well, that's a very reasonable promise, but we're not going to be bound to it. Now, the reality is they will have to tell people before Easter. But it all goes back to Labour sensitivities and that famous ad during the general election campaign, every little hurts with Fine Gael. Water charges were one of those things that would hurt. And now this is getting very real. People are going to find out how much you're going to be paying from October with their bills landing in January. It is just a more politically sensitive issue for Labour than it is for Fine Gael.
Does this to some extent come back to this economic committee within the cabinet, which is basically four people, and the resentment perhaps of others that things are being decided there and leaked as a result in advance of the full cabinet talking about it?
Perhaps that's the case. There's been difficulties with the EMC, John Burton and Simon Coveney. Your two ministers have said that information should be shared more broadly. But I think there was a degree of annoyance between even people around the EMC. This was being discussed at the EMC as recently as earlier this week. They say people around government say negotiations were ongoing. They were only getting kind of hot and heavy in the last few days, but nothing was decided. I think the main issue is the fact that Labour feel they're trying to be bounced into this by Fine Gael. Speaking to people in Labour last night, they felt a very clear direction came from the Taoiseach's office on Monday or Tuesday evening that this had to be out there now and it had to be done now. And they kind of felt, well, hang on a second, we're not ready. And then what they saw yesterday with the information being given out to media organisations was a clear attempt to bounce them into the issue.
How long do you think, or is it clear, before we get the final system announced, the final figures announced, who's in, who's out, on what terms and conditions?
We won't actually get that until later this year, until August, until the Commission for Energy Regulation actually tells us how much we're going to be paying per litre of water we use. How much the government roughly estimates people will pay will be out. I think the next cabinet meeting is April 30th. There's been an Easter break now. The broad expectation was last night, we will know after that. But the exact detail, we won't know that until August. We'll get a rough outline in June from the Commission for Energy Regulation, but it won't to be until well into the late August until we know exactly how much you're going to pay.
All right, well, that next cabinet meeting very close to the local election campaign. But Fiach Kelly, thank you very much. The Dáil's Public Accounts Committee has moved towards the next step in their so far unsuccessful attempts to question Frank Flannery and re-question Angela Kearns about the use of public money given to rehab. On the line, the committee chairperson, John McGuinness. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're writing to them, you're asking to them again to come, and you want replies within 2 weeks. And if not, if they you don't hear back and don't get agreement to come, what then?
Well, what we decided to do last night at our meeting was to write again to both Angela Kearns and to Frank Flannery, and also to each of the agencies that fund rehab and the rehab board, to explain to them the questions that still remain unanswered, to seek from them whatever information that they might have. And then after 2 weeks, or we've given them 2 weeks, after that we will move immediately to an application for compatibility.
Now, this is a power which you think you have, but it's so far under new legislation governing attendance and the powers of Dáil committees, the Oireachtas committees, it's not been tested yet. So are you sure you can compel?
Oh, yeah, I'm under the new legislation on inquiries. There is the possibility of obtaining compatibility from the Committee of Procedure and Privileges in the Dáil. So the process is that you state your case, you legally check your case, and then you submit it to the CPP for consideration. The CPP have just completed their set of regulations under the legislation. It's not compulsory, but they decided that they would put in place regulations to govern such hearings as the one that we propose. They're now in place, or yet they've just been completed by the legal team, I understand, and the CPP will adjudicate on those regulations shortly. Once that happens, then the CPP is available to take applications for compatibility. We already have an application before them, and that will be considered, and then this application will be lodged within a matter of weeks if we do not get the cooperation that we require from all of the agencies and from the two individuals concerned.
How far can this go legally if a citizen says, I'm not prepared to come before you, I don't work in this organisation anymore, you can talk to the directors about what went on. If a citizen says no, can this go to the courts? Are there legal penalties?
Oh, there are indeed. The compatibility is a very serious move to take. It is one that, you know, has not been tested, you're correct in that, but the legislation is there. The CPP will seek outside advice in relation to this. And once you're in compatibility mode, those that you summon as witnesses to attend are obliged to attend because of the fact that you have made a case stating that they have certain connections to the organisation or to the issue, or they have information that would be of benefit to the investigation. And because of the hearing that we've had to date, we, the members of the committee, believe that it is now essential that all of these organisations, their documentation and their personnel would be summoned to the hearing under compatibility if they do not provide the information in a voluntary fashion within the next 2 weeks.
And why do you need to hear it directly from them? Why is it not enough to question people who are still the directors of rehab now about what's going on and to give you whatever information or documents you want?
Well, the two individuals that you're speaking about are no longer employed by rehab, but yet they had particular arrangements between either one and the consultancies, for example, that the board had no knowledge of. In fact, we asked the board a number of questions in relation to different issues, and they were not aware of the detail of those issues or the detail of the arrangements. So therefore, in order to conclude in an accurate way our investigation, it is necessary to hear from the people who were directly involved in that.
Is there anybody else? Sorry, that we go ahead.
It also means that we can send for documents and papers and so on that otherwise would not be available to us if we were not in compatibility mode and acting under that piece of legislation. And that is the inquiry legislation. So it is a powerful position to be in terms of obtaining the information that you require. But once you're dealing with the topic and you're dealing within your remit, well then, that is within the law, and those that you ask are obliged to attend.
All right, well, those letters to Angela Kearns and Frank Flannery will be posted when or sent when?
They will be issued in the next few days, and it will be explained to them exactly what the position is, including the agencies. It's not just about Frank Flannery and Angela Kearns. And then they'll be given 2 weeks from the date of the letter.
All right. John McGuinness, thank you very much for talking to us. Nine, Darren Frehill, here with the sport. Morning, Darren.
And a very good morning to you, Cathal. We'll start with the soccer last night. Real drama in the English Premier League. Manchester City's hopes of winning the title suffered a major setback when they drew 2-2 at home to Sunderland. Real shock, this one. City took the early lead through Fernandinho, but then found themselves chasing the game when Connor Wickham scored twice late in the second half. Samer Nasri did equalise for the home team 2 minutes from time. A really bad blunder by the Sunderland goalkeeper Manone, and that allowed Samer Nasri in to equalise. But City now 6 points behind the leaders Liverpool, and they're 4 points behind second place Chelsea. They do have a game in hand, but they're a long way back. Now, we'll be hearing from the Manchester City manager Manuel Pellegrini in an hour's time, but let's hear from the Sunderland manager Gus Poyet first. He felt a side were a little unlucky not to get all 3 points.
Well, yes, I think we deserve it a bit better. Overall, I'm not analysing the last 5 minutes, which it was very difficult because we want to win. City was coming, there were chances, rebounds and things. I'm analysing the whole game. I'm analysing a team at the bottom of the table conceding after 2 minutes away at Man City, and what probably you, with all respect, or every single people in the world was expecting from this game. But I think that the players understood that we are in a situation where we have to forget about rumors, about stupidity, about people talking and saying and meaning, and just concentrate on what we do.
Yeah, lots of speculation about his future during the weekend. It was one of those games really where a draw really wasn't a great result for either team. Sunderland still down there at the bottom of the Premier League table and have it all to do. Now, it was also a bad night for Everton. Their hopes of securing a place in the Champions League dealt a big blow following a 3-2 defeat at home to Crystal Palace. That loss brought an end to their 7-game winning streak, and it's a remarkable turnaround for Palace. That result leaves them on 40 points. They're now safe from relegation. When Tony Pulis took over, they were rock bottom. That was back in November.
My first game when I went to Hull, we had 4 points. To get 40 points with 4 games left is a remarkable achievement from the players. And what we've got to do now as a group is make sure that, you know, we have a responsibility to the Barclays Premier League for the next 4 games to make sure we turn up and get as many points as we can. And I'll be making sure that hopefully that will be the case.
So Crystal Palace are safe, and that result leaves Arsenal in 4th place in the standings, and they're a point ahead of Everton and just 4 games remaining in the Premier League season. Now in Spain, Gareth Bale scored the winning goal 5 minutes from time as Real Madrid beat Barcelona 2-1 in the Copa del Rey final in Spain. Madrid are also in contention to win La Liga and the Champions League, so the treble is still on for them. Bale's goal, an incredible effort. Do check it out on YouTube if you get an opportunity today. He basically got the ball from the halfway line, took it down the left, beat 2 players and cut in on and beat the goalkeeper on his near side. Terrific goal from him. He's having an incredible season. He scored 20 goals in 38 games for Real Madrid this season, and he's also had 14 assists. In Gaelic games, Kerry will play Tipperary in the semi-finals of the Electric Ireland Munster Minor Football Championship. Jack O'Connor's side had a comfortable win over Clare. Tip beat Waterford by 4 points. Cork were too good for Limerick. They will meet the winners of Limerick and Waterford in the last 4 of that particular competition. In the snooker, real heartbreak for Fergal O'Brien. He's out of the World Championships. He lost in the qualifiers 10-9 to Robbie Williams, and this one will be particularly hard to take because the final frame ended 58-58 and the Dubliner lost on a re-spotted black. This is when the black ball is put back on its spot and the winner of the toss gets the cue ball, and it was decided that way, so he's lost out that way. Peter Ebdon will miss the World Championships for the first time since turning professional 22 years ago. He was beaten by Robin Hull in the final qualifying round. Ken Doherty and Mark Allen can look forward to the draw for the World Championships later this morning. In golf, Lee Westwood is the early leader at the Malaysian Open after an opening round 65. He's 7 under par for the event, so he's a one-shot lead there. Michael Hoey, the leading Irishman, on 5 under par after his first round. He's in a tie for 3rd place. Shane Lowry, Simon Thornton and Damian McGrain also in action there. In the US, Graham McDowell, the only Irish player in action on the PGA Tour. He'll be at Hilton Head for the Heritage this evening. And finally, there's racing in Tipperary this afternoon, and the action there gets underway at 4:35. Lots more sport to come in an hour's time.
Indeed, Darren, we'll talk to you then.
Thanks very much, Cathal. A new tracker by the Irish League of Credit Unions suggests that for all adults, monthly disposable income has increased by €13 over the last year. And for working adults, disposable income has increased by €20 a month since April 2013. There's also been a fall in the number of people who say their disposable income has decreased, and more people are in a position to save compared to this time last year. Kieran Brennan, Chief Executive of the Irish League of Credit Unions, is with us in studio. Kieran, firstly, how do you explain your figures in the light of the figures that were published yesterday by the Central Statistics Office? Yours show an improving picture. The CSO's shows a huge increase in the number of people living in poverty.
I don't think they contradict each other. Ours is, as you know, a quarterly survey. We survey 1,000 people every 3 months. And so it's a snapshot of what's going on now. The CSO's figures are, they're more historical and they're more longitudinal. They go back and make a comparison between what happened in 06, 07, 08 and what's happened now. So they're measuring the overall, if you like, decrease that would have taken place. And we would have seen that every 3 months in our surveys as well. So they match up well.
So take us through your snapshot first of disposable income.
Well, I think you've mentioned the headline figures there, that we're seeing, as it were, a gradual increase in disposable income. It's not that the amount of money going into the households has increased rapidly. It's just that people are managing it so much better. So it's a gradual increase, but an increase in disposable income at the end when they've paid all of their monthly bills. They have more money because they're managing their funds so much better. But still a lot of people in economic pain out there. We've still got 38% of households, for example, who can't pay all of their household bills every single month. We still have 1 million people who have less than €50 a month when they've paid off all of their household bills. But overall, the sentiment is improving.
Has their attitude to bills or their way of coping with bills changed?
Well, if we take an example, we looked at motoring this month and the costs and management of people's driving habits. And what we see there is really good consumer behaviour. One big figure, for example, would be that 60% of people who drive now have changed their motor insurance provider in the last month. That's a huge figure, and it's indicative of the fact that the majority of us are out there seeking value, and that's pushing down, as it were, prices from suppliers, and it's good consumer behaviour overall, learned during the course of this crisis.
And more people are saving as well, which is good for the credit unions.
Yes, that's reflective in our figures. We see a gradual increase month on month in the amount coming in savings into credit unions. Overall, the survey tells us it's up from 39% of people who can save to 44%. The average amount that's being saved has risen from 170 to 177 euros per month. That might seem modest, but what it means is people are moving from a situation where they couldn't save anything to where they can save something, no matter how modest that is.
Now, your statement says that over the past 12 months, the first signs of a possible economic recovery are visible. That's one of your quotes. It's quite conditional. What's it depending on?
As I say, no increase in the money going into households, but there are some cost increases that households have had to deal with, including the property tax and also child-related expenses. So things like the cost of putting kids in a creche and so on has gone up. But what we're seeing is more people are beginning to choose to do so. So, for example, you might have people who are returning to work who didn't need external child minding who now need to pay for it. Others who would have had the granny minding the kids now have the choice to pay for it. And they're making that discretionary choice. It's non-essential spending that they are choosing to do. Extracurricular activity in schools, more expenditure on that. That is discretionary. In other words, people are beginning to decide we are going to spend money. That's good for the economy.
Okay.
That's a fragile return of confidence.
So childcare costs expanding as are household costs and water charges ahead. Kieran Brennan, Chief Executive of the Irish League of Credit Unions, thanks very much for joining us in studio this morning. Briefly, drinks group Diageo, which owns Guinness, Baileys and Smirnoff, among other brands, has reported a small increase in sales over the past 9 months, thanks to a strong performance in North and South America. In a trading statement this morning, Diageo says its sales for the 9 months to the end of March were up 0.3%, and that's despite weakness in Western Europe and Southeast Asia, where Diageo says sales have suffered because of political instability in one of its key markets, and that's Thailand. On the currency markets, the euro is trading at $1.38 and at 82 pence sterling.
Emma, thank you very much. Political temperatures are rising at Leinster House after yesterday's cabinet meeting on water charges. It's an announcement Enda Kenny promised to make before the local elections, but it's also something that could, and it seems is, striking fear into the hearts of some members of the Labour Party, especially before the local elections. Well, as frictions grow at national level, Cian McCormack is on the ground at a local level assessing the voters' mood. He's made his way from Galway to Boyle and Ballyhadrine, and he joins us now from our Midlands studio in Athlone. Cian, we heard the first utterances of voter anger over water charges from Galway yesterday, but did you hear more of that as your journey continued?
Well, I'll tell you, Claire, the water issue is certainly more prominent now than it was at the beginning of the week, and that probably reflects what we've heard over the past day or so. Farmers, solicitors, housewives, they all had opinions when I stopped up to chat with them on my journey from Galway, but we'll talk more about that later. First, before leaving Galway, I went to the Age Action Ireland office and I met 74-year-old Anne McManus, chairperson of the Salthill Active Retirement Association.
Thank God my health is good, but I don't know when the day is coming when it won't be so good. I would be concerned about healthcare. I don't have a medical card. It's becoming increasingly difficult to pay for health. And I also find that we help our children. I think that's a fact that politicians forget. They say, oh, the pensioners never had it so good. But in actual fact, we help our children quite considerably in various ways from our own savings. And I don't think that's something that's taken into account whatsoever.
Well, Anne McManus there was in Salt Hill. But Cian, you travelled on to Roscommon, stopping at Ballinasloe to meet farmers at the mart. What were they telling you?
Concerns over beef prices, water charges, they were all at the heart of what they were talking to me about. But what was really, really interesting was this farmer's voting intentions.
Water charges now, that's going to be the next thing. It's coming on now, it's one thing after another. I'm self-employed, never looked for anything off the estate. 45 years of age, never looked for anything off the estate.
Will you vote?
I don't know. I'd be very choosy to know who I'm going to vote for. Maybe this thing needs a good shake-up, you know, but I strongly consider who I am going to vote for now this time. You know, before it was kind of loyalty to people, but when I wanted any help, I never looked for it. I never got it either.
The state of the roads.
The roads, that's the first thing.
Yes.
Anything else?
Household charge.
Household charge, anything else?
Yeah, the water charges, I'd be totally against them.
Common Town was my next stop after Ballinasloe. After 25 years and the closure of its A&D in 2011, the hospital remains a political hot potato. I spoke to John McDermott, chairperson of the Roscommon Hospital Action Committee.
The situation has been that the accident emergency department services were terminated in June 2011. And the situation is the hospital is still there. It is treating elective patients. So if you've been booked in for a procedure or investigation, that's fine. It's still providing that service. It is the number one issue in Roscommon, without question. No matter what politician you talk to from whatever party, they'll tell you that the accident emergency department, the accident emergency services, are the crucial services and are the main political issue.
So, Cian, almost 3 years on, is the hospital really still an issue with people there?
Well, you know, when I was talking to people, it seems to be the case. It's the first thing that they tend to bring up, but they have some other concerns too.
In Roscommon Town, I suppose, fundamentally, the issue of the hospital and the closure of the hospital.
Well, I suppose the water is the main thing, the boil water. We have a lot of queries of boil water notices and that type of thing at the moment. Apart from that, then just try and get some industry and that into the town and get the town up and running again.
How much are you spending a week on water?
It can be anything from 10 to 15 euro a week between lunches and everyday hygiene and that type of thing. So.
Well, news is just emerging about new water charges.
Well, I'm already paying a meter because we have a farm. So I definitely don't think I'd be prepared to pay on a house meter when I'm buying the water as well. I think it's very unfair.
You mightn't have a choice.
Well, I don't know, but
is it a local election issue?
Well, I would think so. I think it's something that they need to do and look at, that there's some reason all the water that's fallen, there has to be some way of harvesting it and maintaining a healthy supply to houses.
Employment would be a big issue here. There's not a lot.
Well, later in the programme, I'll be telling you about one email that led to me meeting some County Roscommon resident residents whose water has been polluted for the past 15 months. But until then, I can be contacted with comments, contributions and opinions at elections@rte.ie.
Cian McCormack, thank you very much. We look forward to hearing from Cian in the next hour on the programme.